Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, what do you know? Another weekend, another game changer for Wall Street. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley have decided that maybe investment banking's not the business to be in these days. Congress and the Treasury Department are dickering over how to spend $700 billion, or maybe more. However much it does turn out to be, the trickle-down effects have already started. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, helping America go green. You can calculate your carbon savings at publictransportation.org. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, makers of ThinkPad and new IdeaPad notebook PCs, dedicating 1% of income, supporting entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Monday. It's the 22nd of September today. And as we continue our special coverage of the story that has turned the financial markets upside down, it pays to remember this. For months, this story played out this way. Whatever Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke wanted to happen, pretty much happened. As of today, though, Congress is in on the game, and that is going to change things. Maya McGinnis is the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And Maya, I have to ask you, what do you think is going to happen to this Paulson plan?
Well, in the end, I think this bill is going to move through Congress really quickly. Nobody wants to be the person who they can point the finger at and say, you know, you held up the bill at a time when financial markets are screaming for help. But I do think there are a lot of changes that members of Congress would like to see. And frankly, they want to flex a little bit of muscle and show that this isn't completely the Treasury's package, but they still have some say in the matter. So I think the types of things that we're most likely to see are the issue of CEO compensation. A lot of politicians don't think it's right for CEOs to be walking away with millions of dollars when this kind of a bailout package is in play. And I think we're also likely to see other areas of fiscal stimulus brought into the bill, whether it's help for mortgage relief or other things to kind of keep the economy moving as the weakness permeates through the whole economy.
Secretary Paulson went up to the Hill with a bill that I think was about 2.5-3 pages long. Chris Dodd, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, has a version that's about 44 pages long. What are we not including in these packages, which will eventually be tacked on?
We're not including two things. We're not including a real understanding of how we got into this mess, and so making sure that the response is targeted to the real problems. But we're also not seeing a lot of kind of economic help for other sectors of the economy. So as we see continued job losses, we see continued problems in the housing market, there are going to be cries to make sure that the people who are affected there are helped out.
I gather by what you just said that you don't think we're done with bailout packages here.
Once there's a train that's moving, Congress wants to be a part of that train. And if this bill moves as quickly as it's likely to, there will be a lot of people who still have ideas for good ways to spend the government's money. Also, we can't forget, it's an election year, and people want to put promises out there and bring voters over to their side. So there are going to be a lot of cries for different ways that they think they could spend government money and ultimately help the economy and taxpayers.
$700 billion is obviously a crazy amount of money. What's that going to do to the rest of the economy? And if we borrow that much to spend that much, what's that going to mean?
This is a huge amount of money. This is more than the entire budget deficit for this coming year. And we already are in a situation where we have budget deficits as far as we can look into the future. So what this means is that interest rates could go up. It's going to have an effect on our currency. We have to bump up our debt limit. And the real problem is, are people going to want to keep lending money to the United States when we seem to have an unlimited appetite for borrowing? It's going to call into question a lot of the promises that both Senators McCain and Obama have put out on the campaign trail. There's really not room to be talking about increasing the budget deficit right now. We need to think about belt tightening through all sectors of the economy. But how do you do that without making any economic slowdown that we're encountering worse than it already is?
Secretary Paulson has said he really wants this thing done this week. Congress wants to get out of town to go home and campaign for the elections. What are the hazards, though, of doing something so monumental so quickly?
There's no question that we will look back and say that was a record amount of time to spend $700 billion or whatever the amount of money turns out to be, and mistakes will be made. It may be necessary right now, but it's certainly going to be something that we look back on and say, wasn't there a way for government to be more out in front of these issues so that when the time comes to get involved, we can do so with more thought having gone into it?
Maya McGinnis is the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Maya, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
It's not like Uncle Sam's got $700 billion lying around in the petty cash drawer, right? The government's going to have to sell treasury bonds to raise the money. Shouldn't have too much trouble finding buyers, but there could be some long-term consequences of all that borrowing, as our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
To come up with money for the bailout, the Treasury Department is benefiting from a rush to safe investments. There's healthy demand right now for Treasury securities, says Marilyn Cohen of Envision Capital.
We're going to once again have to lean on the kindness of foreigners. You'll see public pension funds and just, you know, the usual players that like to have the safety of U.S. Treasury bonds.
But she says Treasury will have to pay higher interest rates to attract new debt holders, and that could raise longer-term interest rates for other borrowers. Cohen also worries that all this government debt could undermine the value of the dollar. But Fred Bergsten at the Peterson Institute for International Economics doesn't think that will last.
If the markets think that the U.S. is really getting the problem under control, and maybe even more quickly than other countries, it could actually strengthen the exchange rate of the dollar.
The price of oil reversed its recent decline today, closing above $120 a barrel. Economics professor Randall Ray at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, says that's due in part to oil traders thinking demand for that commodity is on the rise.
It could be that the markets rallied a little bit because they think the recession won't be as severe as it might have been if we had just continued with these rolling financial institution failures.
But many analysts today said these are short-term psychological reactions to news of the bailout, and more lasting consequences depend on details of the final package. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Secretary Paulson said this weekend he wants the bailout to be open to all banks with what he calls significant operations in the United States, regardless of who owns those banks. That might not play too well in Congress, though. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains that American taxpayers may wind up bailing out more foreign banks than American ones.
Foreign banks have been among the biggest casualties of the subprime debacle. UBS of Switzerland alone has already written off more than $40 billion in toxic assets. Peter Hahn is a former American investment banker and now a lecturer at the Cass Business School in London. He can understand why American taxpayers may not want to bail out foreign banks.
The Royal Bank of Scotland or Union Bank of Switzerland or Crédit Agricole, they took risks like everybody else. They're big, sophisticated organizations. Why should the, you know, the U.S. taxpayers support their shareholders?
Nevertheless, Hahn supports the global reach of the bailout. He says that as the dominant force in the global economy, the U.S. had to take a broad approach. Economist Andrew Hilton agrees, but says the U.S. taxpayers shouldn't and won't shoulder the whole burden.
Other governments will be forced to do something similar, perhaps not on as grand a scale, but something similar.
No foreign government has stepped up to the plate so far, but, says Peter Hahn, they could be induced to do so. Paulson could insist on the U.S. getting a large equity stake in all the foreign banks that it bails out.
Certain foreign governments might not like Paulson's bank to own a major share, and that might encourage them to contribute to the process and buy the securities themselves rather than let Paulson's bank do it.
Hahn says the condition of an equity stake might even make the Paulson plan more palatable to the beleaguered American taxpayers. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Wall Street made it clear today traders don't think too highly of the Paulson bailout package. We will have the details when we do the numbers. This may come as the least surprising obituary ever, but Wall Street, as we knew it, died last night. We were already down to two big independent investment banks after the sale of Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch and the demise of Lehman Brothers. Now Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley have thrown in the towel. They've become what are called bank holding companies. I guess that doesn't really translate, though. What it means in practice is that the two will face more government regulation, they won't be able to take as many risks, and they will make less money. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more now from New York.
Right now, for every dollar Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley have in the bank, they're borrowing about $30 to buy their investments. That's some serious leverage, and they may have to cut it in half when they become bank holding companies. Christopher Whalen is managing director at Institutional Risk Analytics. He says while neither bank would have wanted this a year ago,
you know what? If the choice is between survival and subjecting yourself to the bank regulatory world, you choose the latter.
Whalen says they'll have to give the government greater access to their balance sheets, but in return, they'll get access to the Fed's discount loan window. And they'll finally be playing on the same field as their competition, which might be good news for them.
The broker-dealers like Bear and Lehman, Goldman, all of them, Merrill Lynch, were second-class citizens in the old regime. They had to clear through a bank. Bear Stearns had to clear through J.P. Morgan. They didn't have direct access to the Fed. So now they are going to have an equal playing field.
David Stoll is a professor of finance at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. He says the two investment banks were probably forced into their status change by the Fed.
But they're also being pressured by their clients. For example, hedge funds in particular are very sensitive, having seen Lehman go bankrupt recently, to seeing a less leveraged model, a less risky balance sheet, so they can have confidence in the firms.
And it seems that holy grail, restoring confidence, is the surest way out of this crisis for all banks. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
This week, more than most, we're being asked to take what the government's doing on faith. Faith that the people in charge know what's best. That seems like an especially risky proposition with $700 billion on the line. So we called Jay Light, the dean at the Harvard Business School, to get his thoughts on it. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Secretary Paulson is essentially saying to Congress, listen, trust me on this $700 billion. You buying that? Do you trust him?
It's a big amount of money. It's a big problem, and it deserves a big response. I think about an analogy with an emergency room in a hospital. You've got a victim of an accident coming in. Task number one is to get a tourniquet on the problem, to make sure you respond to the crisis at hand. Strategy number two is to fix in the short run, the intermediate run, whatever the issue might be, and to get them back on their feet and out of the hospital. And issue number three is to think about rehabilitation and getting them back to what would in fact be a satisfactory long-term situation.
But assuming we get that tourniquet on, some of the smartest minds on Wall Street weren't good enough to keep this train wreck from happening. What makes you think anybody in government's smart enough to fix it?
Well, look, I think that there are some terribly important questions as to how the $700 billion fund is in fact implemented. The biggest of which for me would be what kind of process do we have for thinking about exactly which kinds of assets are purchased from whom at what prices. We don't know who the new administration is going to be. We don't know who the next Secretary of the Treasury is going to be. I have a certain amount of faith that the kind of person who will be appointed to do that and the kind of team that he or she will appoint is the kind of team that can flexibly and adaptively implement this proposal over time.
Well, let me ask you this then. What are some pitfalls that that team might run into?
Certainly a big thing that we have to think about is what kind of, if you will, incentives do we set in place for the long run here? There has to be a regulatory quid pro quo for most of this, and I think thinking very carefully through the evolution of the regulatory system that will have to proceed in tandem with the $700 billion. That is, in fact, another really important element here. You know, one thing to keep in mind is what's being proposed here is, because of the situation, much more complex than the RTC solution.
The RTC, the Resolution Trust Corporation from Savings and Loan Days.
Yeah, because there what we did is we just threw the whole institution in the pot, right? We paid off the depositors or basically transferred the deposit base to other institutions, and we just took over all the assets and liquidated them. That's actually not what this proposal is. which means there are many more important and difficult problems and issues and details that have to be worked out, and on a industry by industry and sector by sector, and maybe situation by situation basis, in order to get a sensible resolution of at what price do the assets really go in.
But about those assets, sir, it's not as if just because the government takes them over, these incredibly complicated collateralized debt obligations and mortgage-backed securities instantaneously get simpler just because the government buys them. They are still largely unknown.
They're complex. It's that we take the things that have less transparency out of some of the private institutions at some price, and if you will, socialize their risks and transparency. And that presumably could be a very helpful step.
Jay Light is the dean at the Harvard Business School. Thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Coming up, college kids vote too, you know.
The issue of the economy was the number one concern among young people. This is the first time in the last 5 years that we've done our survey that an issue other than Iraq was number one.
But first, let's do the numbers. Name your poison, gang. Worries about political wrangling over the bailout bill, renewed concern over consumer spending and further economic weakness, or a record spike in oil prices. They all conspired to wipe out most of Friday's gains and drive the Dow Industrials down 372 points, 3.25%. The blue chip index closed at 11,015. The NASDAQ dropped 94 points, 4.1%, finished at 2178. The S&P 500 sank 47 points, that is 3.8%. Wrapped up the trading day at 12.07. Financial stocks, of course, were back to being the big losers. Led by Washington Mutual, investors withdrew more than 21% of that stock's value. JP Morgan Chase 13% lower. Wells Fargo stock lost more than 11%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Senate Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on Iraq and Afghanistan. The House Ways and Means Health Subcommittee discusses problems in the private health insurance market. And restaurateurs convene in Washington for the National Restaurant Association Public Affairs Conference. One item on the menu, rising food prices. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Both presidential candidates have been talking tough about the economy. Not like they really had an option. John McCain said this morning he wants a bipartisan oversight committee to keep an eye on how Henry Paulson spends that $700 billion he's about to get his hands on. At a speech in Green Bay today, Barack Obama announced that he'll hire a chief performance officer to make sure the government's spending taxpayer money wisely. There is some irony there, because amid all the uncertainty about how this bailout is going to work, commentator and economist Robert Shapiro points out that $700 billion is a whole lot of money not to have.
Whatever we do, this bailout will use up virtually all the resources the next president needs to bring about whatever changes he's envisioning. That's because the government will need those resources to buy up all those devalued mortgage-backed securities and their derivatives. The direct costs of buying up all those falling securities will come over the next several months. But any revenues the Treasury eventually recoups from selling them back to the market, that won't happen for years, if ever. and that leaves the next president facing a deficit of $600 to $700 billion, maybe more. There goes the money for President Obama to expand health care coverage, or for President McCain to cut corporate taxes or extend President Bush's tax cuts for wealthy people. And next, President Obama may have to trade off a major push on alternative fuels against those new tax cuts for the middle class, while President McCain may have to give up extending tax relief for dividends or the funding for his educational reforms. Both candidates also may face a version of the dilemma European leaders faced in the 1960s and 1970s when they gave up plans to maintain strong military spending in order to elaborate their social welfare protections. Here, this time, the next president's promises to expand the army may well give way to new subsidies, not for poor working people, but for the financial institutions that once presided so proudly over the global economy. Since most of the bailout's costs should come in the next 2 years or so, they shouldn't constrain the new president's longer-term plans for perhaps one major initiative. That is, if he still has any public support left after failing to deliver on all those other promises he's making right now.
Robert Shapiro used to be the Undersecretary of Commerce in the Clinton administration. He is now the chairman of the consulting group Sonicon. You know where to send your thoughts. It's letters at marketplace.org. That $700 billion we're collectively going to have to borrow to bail out the global economy could wind up being a whole lot more. And if that does happen, it's going to handcuff the country and what it's going to be able to do in the future beyond even what Robert Shapiro was just talking about. Most of us aren't going to be around to pay the bills and see the long-term impact, but kids graduating from college this year might. At the same time they're entering the real world, the class of 2008 is also going to be heading to the polls this November, some of them for the first time. And in this first installment of our election series, Interested Parties, we wanted to find out what recent graduates and current students want from the next administration. So we sent Marketplace's Sean Cole to ask around.
So no radio story about recently graduated seniors would be complete without this music. And maybe some pearl of wisdom from a commencement speaker, like today's show host Meredith Vieira.
I've interviewed presidents, and I've interviewed poor people just trying to make it. I actually prefer the latter group, to be honest with you.
Which is apropos, considering that a lot of these kids are asking themselves, which presidential candidate is going to keep me from becoming a poor person?
The job hunt hasn't been as successful as I had hoped.
I have been taking those jobs that don't really pay you.
When do you finish?
Ideally August.
And then what?
Then I hope to start working and making money.
That's only one of their economic concerns heading towards this election year.
John Della Volpe is the director of polling at the Harvard Institute of Politics. He's citing a biannual survey of more than 2,000 18 to 24-year-olds. Half of them are in four-year colleges and universities. The other half is a mishmash, graduates, high schoolers. And right before commencement this past spring,
The issue of the economy was the number one concern among young people. This is the first time in the last 5 years that we've done our survey that an issue other than Iraq was number one.
Partly because young people are starting to think of every issue as an economic issue, including the war. Right, young people?
Definitely.
Absolutely.
I mean, everything boils down to being an economic issue.
They certainly look at kind of our energy and environmental policy as an economic issue. They even look at healthcare as an economic issue.
Not to mention Social Security, which all of the young people I spoke with had something to say about.
Yeah, when I'm older, I definitely expect the government to take care of me.
Rahul Chundiok is 21. Finishing up his bachelor's degree in business administration at the University of Southern California, he says Social Security better be around when he's older.
Because, I mean, otherwise it's like, why don't I just, take that money and invest it in, like, a pension fund or something?
Which I think is what Bush has been saying, like, maybe we should all just invest it instead.
The thing with that, though, is, like, I feel like in order to get a good long-term return from one of those funds, you kind of have to be somewhat educated in that field, and You know, I mean, like, I've taken one course in investments and, you know, barely scratched the surface.
Whereas Sarah Garten feels like she just doesn't know enough about Social Security in general.
The way that I've looked at it since I got my first job when I was, like, 16 was just like, oh, there's an extra, like, 10 bucks I didn't get, you know, like, that I can't, like, buy pizza with.
Sarah just graduated from Boston University with a cultural anthropology degree. She's from Texas, but stuck around the area for the summer, working a temporary job for 14 bucks an hour. Her thoughts on the topic at hand are, in short, Social Security, schmocial security.
I guess I don't really trust it. I'm not counting on it by any means. I don't think I can count on anything. So yeah.
On anything, that's very nihilistic.
Uh-oh. But I'm an idealist. I believe in the good of people. Anything that the government is promising me, I don't think I can count on.
Besides, Sarah's more concerned with the here and now. Her college health care and housing both ran out this month, so she had to find an affordable insurance plan and a new apartment, which she's trying to figure out how to pay for. Sound familiar? Again, John Della Volpe.
These issues are kind of intertwined, and they affect people in their 20s just as much, or if not more, than people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s.
I had the fortune of working for Social Security last year, which was kind of an eye-opening job to have.
David Anderson is a grad student in political science at the University of New Hampshire. You heard him laughing before. He says Social Security is not the inefficient, wasteful bureaucracy it's thought to be. In fact, he says it's too efficient.
It's become so tight-pocketed to avoid the fraud that the people who really need it aren't even getting it.
And that's what you'd like to see change.
Yeah, I would like to see that change. Personally, I have a heart murmur, which shouldn't affect me, at least until I'm into my old age. But it's kind of that knowledge that at some point something could happen completely out of my control.
At 29, David's a little older than the demographic we've been talking about so far, but he still fits into that under 30 set that could really drive this upcoming election. John Della Volpe told me that in the 2004 election, voters under 30 outnumbered those over 65 by a million. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
It'd be great if you would tell us about your economic interest in this election. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says Interested Parties.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
A couple of quick final notes before we go now. On that oil spike today, you need to remember this. That was for the October futures contract, which expired this afternoon. November starts trading tomorrow at about $108 a barrel. That's about 12 bucks below where October closed today. And maybe gas is expensive, but at least most of us can get it. Some cities in the southeast, Houston and Atlanta in particular, are reporting serious shortages, as in gas stations closing because they don't have any gas. What they do have is expensive, better than $4 a gallon, thanks to refinery shortages since Hurricane Ike. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Thanks to the financial crisis on Wall Street today, the Dow fell 372 points, 3.25%. The NASDAQ lost 94 points, 4.1%. The S&P 500 dipped 47 points. That is 3.8% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, we continue our special coverage of the banking blitz on Wall Street. Where, oh, where is that bailout going to end? And oh, by the way, what happens next? I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy.
In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.